A Pod Forte Podcast.
The next CMO podcast explores topics that are on the minds of forward-thinking marketing executives, from leadership and strategy to emerging technologies. And we bring these topics to life by interviewing leading experts in their fields. The Next CMO is sponsored by Plana, makers of the world's first AI-based marketing leadership platform, and hosted by me, Peter Mahoney, the founder and CEO of Plana, along with my co-host, Kelsey Kraft. In this episode of the Next CMO podcast, I speak to Rob Willey, CMO of Cherrybundi, makers of a tart cherry juice supplement known for being rich in antioxidants. Because of its effectiveness, Cherrybundi has a unique connection with the athletic world. They have nearly 350 collegiate and professional sports teams that use Cherrybundi in their daily training routines. Rob speaks to us about his athletic influencers campaign, the role they play in marketing, how effective they've been, how he measures them, and how to recruit this kind of athletic influencer. I hope you enjoy the show. Hey, Rob, thank you so much for joining us on the Next CMO podcast. Really excited for this discussion to talk about D2C and the Cherrybundi story. And maybe you can set the table a little bit by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and a little bit about Cherrybundi.
Peter, thanks for having me. My name is Rob Willey. I am the Chief Marketing Officer of Cherrybundi and an operating partner at Amil Capital. I've spent pretty much my entire career in D2C startups, beginning one of the most notable D2C startups that there ever was, Method, and the soap company. I spent my time there working in e-commerce. And as at that point, which was the head of digital, which was in the internet, was in its infancy phases, and have gone on to run marketing at companies like TaskRabbit, Spring, and now most recently Cherrybundi, which is a tart cherry company based here in Portland, Oregon. We've been around the block for actually quite some time. We were founded in the early 2000s and have since gone on to develop, design, create to a lot of different degrees this idea around the importance of recovery, and in particular in sports nutrition. So tart cherry juice is a proven scientific recovery agent that helps athletes, everyday athletes, professional athletes, and everything in between improve recovery, specifically around anti-inflammation and sleep. And so we work with over 400 sports teams, professional amateur teams. We're in 50,000 placements throughout the U.S. It's a large business that, frankly, I've been hired to help everyone find out about it, because there are so many people that just have never heard about tart cherry juice, and we're here to bring it to the masses.
Excellent. And you'll get at least a couple of more people you can educate during this podcast today, Rob. So I'm excited to dig in and talk about it a little bit. And one of the things I was going to ask you about is, as you mentioned, the brand's been around for a while, almost 20 years, not quite, maybe 18 or so. And you came on board to relaunch, revitalize the brand. So tell me a little bit about how you approached that. What was it like before, I guess, PR, pre-Rob and post-R, which is also PR. So pre-Rob and post-Rob, what was the Cherrybundi brand all about, and how did it?
I think Cherrybundi, like a lot of young startups, right, in its first sort of chapter, was bootstrapped together with small distribution. It was born out of Cornell University, so the science was proven. Yet, like many other young companies, particularly in beverage, which is the land of titans, right? You have every large beverage brand. And at that point in time, the world was built at retail. The early e-commerce story, just the unit economics didn't work for heavy product filled with liquid to be shipped in the mail. And whether that was soap, which is where I learned it at Method, or tart cherry juice, it was the same cost inefficiencies that no one, including Amazon, really wanted to grow. And so that business was built offline. And that is a place that is very difficult to compete, right, with large brands like Pepsi and Coca-Cola. They own shelf space. They have budgets well beyond any young company has. And it's a monopoly to a large degree at your local grocery store. So the brand was really trying to fight those headwinds throughout its first sort of decade as it came to life and people started to find out more and more about the power of tart cherry juice. I arrived 3+ years ago, and to a large degree, the company was still maintaining that playbook, right? Built offline, large retail footprint nationally, trying to fight the fight at Walmart and Costco and every other local grocery store, and then doing paid media deals with large, oftentimes sports properties like ESPN. But the playbook was really emulating exactly what Gatorade was doing or what Pepsi or Coke or Body Armor was doing. And then that is a hard place to compete. And so we had to take a hard look at our go-to-market strategy, our positioning, our packaging, and say, really, what do we need to think about doing differently? We know as a beverage brand, there are some category things that you need to do to support a retail business, but those things feel like the wrong answer. And so that is where we started, which was a hard look at ourselves. And what we began to realize is that we could not outspend, particularly in paid media, those large companies that were trying and already had large market share. So we said, okay, we're going to do something differently. The truth is that, I guess, Peter, have you ever heard of tart cherry juice before you talked to me?
I had heard of the concept before, but I have not heard of this specific brand before we spoke.
100%, I had exactly the same story. So I arrived at the company. Amil Capital has asked me to move into an operating role as CMO of Terabunny. And the first thing I said is, who's that? Right? And that's how so many people meet startups, right? Is we as consumers or as marketing executives are saying, what? And you have to go Google it. And you have to figure out who they are. And you have to understand what they're all about. And I had the same journey that you're having right now, which is I had to learn about the power of tart cherry juice. I had to learn about Terabunny. And doing so, what I quickly realized, which is the company's like secret weapon, is not only is it the most efficacious or the most powerful tart cherry juice in the market. So the product's scientifically proven it's best in class. But beyond that, we had at that point over 250 professional collegiate sports teams that actually pay and order the product from us every month. And those are dietitians on these teams that are less interested in your marketing and more interested in actually is the product actually going to help their athletes in results. And so they are the proving ground. I was like, oh man, this must really work. Tell me more. And so as I started to figure that out in my learning curve and joining the company, to answer your question, pre-Rob, post-Rob, what do? I was like, we got to go talk to those people because they're the true experts. We just need to put our products in these people's hands, whether they be registered dietitians or athletes, or frankly, fitness experts, influencers, people online that actually can just do education themselves simply by telling their stories because they're already buying the product. Just no one knew about it. And so I tried to find those things to then build a platform on versus just buy media.
I love this story, Rob, because it brings two really important concepts to light that are things that I often try to advocate that marketing leaders pursue. One is look at secular changes. What's going on in the world that your brand participates in? And in yours, there was this huge change when it came to e-commerce versus retail distribution. And obviously during the pandemic, that's been further accelerated and people are buying more and more brands online. But as you said, there was this change where the economics didn't work to sell a product directly to consumers. And then all of a sudden it did. And so that's one, what's changing in the world. And then the second thing is listen to your customers. And it's amazing when you dive into what customers are doing with your product and find the real success stories, how much value you can get out of that. And it's incredible. I think you said about 400 teams now are using Cherabundi as a regular thing. And like you said, they're buying it. It's not like these are people you're paying to say good things about it. So tell me about how you leaned into that. So how do you go promote and find and accelerate the adoption from that kind of a real amazing built-in influencer community for your product?
Yeah. I think another way of saying, Peter, what you're saying is, and I say this all the time, marketing is the tax you pay for being unremarkable. And that's weird for a marketing person to say that. It's almost like a sad state of affairs. But it's truly what I believe. Like, I didn't set out, I will not set out as an executive to make marketing. All of us want to skip marketing, frankly, like whether it be on YouTube or on Instagram or any other place we spend our time. We're just trying to avoid ads. And why would any one of us aspire to make things people don't want to see? And so with that philosophy, we said, okay, we have this small but powerful group of people who are true people of interest, true influencers. How can we amplify them? And so the first thing we did was we created what we call the Pit Crew. Cute name, clever name, it's funny, haha. But it's what it is, a roster of influencers, athletes, experts that we started just one by one building an all-natural army is another way to say it, because our product is all natural. It is not from concentrate. It is really why our product, although it does have sugar, is better than so many of the other products on the market, in that ingredients matter. And it's a weird also thing to say in this day and age that we have to restate that, but in our category called sports nutrition, it's a notable difference. So we said, oh, all natural products, people who use them every day, and these people are thought leaders. Let's bring them all together, call them, badge them, create an like an actual identity around them, bring them together online in community, and just let them showcase how to use our products and tell everyone why it's important and actually the actual results. So that's what we did. And it was, honestly, there was a lot of intention, but there was also a lot of time and energy, because we were really thoughtful about drafting those people. It wasn't by accident. It wasn't by budget, frankly. It was like we looked at profile after profile. We built a team internally that we didn't outsource influencer marketing to an agency to go just sample our products and pay people to post. We actually casted them, is how we talk about them. And one by one, we found these personnel to give us a look and a feel and a voice that I didn't have to manufacture. And it's not the easiest route. In fact, it's why most big companies don't want to do it. It's hard. It's high time. And so as a young company, that would be one thing I would talk about is we do make this personal. And I know people on the podcast can't see me, but like I have a hat that says Beast of Habit. It's our Cherubundi hat. Like we have merch. We distribute our merch and our products all the time because this is something we live and breathe. And 3 years later, we now have athlete investors like Debo Samuel, like Lindsey Horan. Like we have A-list investors that are big time athletes that chose to invest in the company, as well as, of course, use our products, talk about it to people that hopefully care. And then we also have a roster of registered dietitians from these leading teams that are on our recovery advisory council. And so we've built all of this scaffolding to help us now take this program and this product.
It's really incredible what you've done, Rob, in a relatively short period of time. And a couple of things that you mentioned are really interesting. I wanted to dig into a little bit more. One is the idea of what to outsource and what to insource. And I'm a big believer in this too, that certain things, when it comes to finding those people, and I like that you think of it as casting those people who are true representatives of your brand, especially in this kind of a mode where it's such an important thing. They are literally the personification of your brand, or you hope they are. I can't think of a more important kind of decision. And it's very easy to think about, we'll have the agency do that. And I love agencies and they're wonderful and they're great for scale and great for new thinking and creative. But some things you just have to do yourself. And it's like content. A lot of people really outsource content. And unless you really understand what you're dealing with and you're really part of the brand, it's very difficult to do and make that happen. And what an endorsement to have some of the people who are customers to become investors. That's the ultimate, obviously, is to get people to come to that level. I wanted to go back, though, for a minute and talk a little bit about distribution, because it's a really important thing to think about. Obviously, there's huge value in retail when it comes to things like reach. So if you can turn on the retail channel, and I know you have a bunch of really premium retail channels where you sell the Cherrybundy products. How do you think about the relationship between those retail distributors and your direct-to-consumer kind of business? Do they feed off each other? Do they compete with each other? How do you think about that, Rob?
It's tricky. It's tricky. If you ask them, they'd tell you our online business probably competes with their offline business, because their job is to drive people in store. And we want them to do that. And in mass, we 100% love our retailers, support our retailers, right? This business was born in retail. So from that standpoint, we do believe this business must have a strong retail footprint. That said, COVID, as you said, only made the online sort of move faster. However, beyond that sort of escalation, I do think we are meeting new consumers who are more interested in trial online than ever before. And so what we try to do is two things online. One is, the most, specifically in beverage, the most popular products on Amazon are variety packs. And you wonder why that is. You're like, I am not a huge variety pack consumer to my most loyal product. I know exactly the product that I like. That said, that tells me, that signals to brands like us, oh, there is an opportunity for trial here that might not be otherwise. People are interested in trying all of our products to see maybe if one of them is their favorite first. So with that trial opportunity, we say, oh, maybe we need to meet our consumers via acquisition. And we look at paid social and PR and the other sort of startup playbook of today that good startups utilize, is to meet consumers and drive education and purchase intent. And that's what we believe a lot of e-commerce, and it's Amazon, Walmart.com form, really is for. Then on the other side of that spectrum is our most loyal consumers. The people that love, buy, share our products all the time. And the truth is, with tart cherry juice, you need to drink at least 8 ounces a day to feel the benefits. We have a huge group of everyday users, people that love and are our most loyal consumers. Those are the people that we want to actually have direct relationships with, that we can service better than, say, retail can. Because we talk to them, we listen to them, we actually want to make new products for them. And so that is how we kind of function within the frame of retail, is understanding that there are different need states, use cases of our primary audience that both on and offline can functionally service, but their behaviors are slightly different. And so we just want to meet them where they are. A brand like us, as big enough as we are, we actually can't just do one thing, right? You can't just be offline. You can't just be online. We've seen a lot of good D2C brands in history, specifically in the past few years, go offline. You know, whether that be through their own brick and mortar sort of flagship stores in major cities, or if they've actually decided to go in with a store in store or an actual retail position in these larger stores, everyone has realized that, yes, you need to be able to do both. And I think good D2C brands show up in those venues, understanding why consumers are meeting them there versus just doing it all the same way. And so we've tried to understand the nuance. For example, our larger format products, our 32-ounce products, have a huge online, offline business. Huge. Our smaller products, which are more single-serve, have a huge online business. When you divide those things, you start to realize, oh, these behaviors are different. And to your point, Peter, we're like, we go to the consumer. We try to build backwards. And for me, being an outsider and not being here at the beginning, not founding this company, it gave me the opportunity to be skeptical, be curious, but really look hard at the business and say, how do we need to outmaneuver maybe our competition in a way that does have some strategic thought and some decisions that we can make and be flexible with? And that's my typical point of view, but it's also how we've been able to divide and conquer our retail footprint.
So it's interesting, Rob, that it's a little counterintuitive what you were saying about which format of products they're buying in each channel. I would have thought it would have been opposite, So I think what you said is that people are buying the large format products offline more and the single serve products online. Did I get that right?
That's correct.
So I would have assumed that it was the other thing, unless it's more expensive to ship the bigger thing. I would have thought, hey, if there's some big heavy thing, why am I going to carry it home in my shopping bag? Why don't I have someone send me 6 32-ounce jugs in the mail so I don't have to take it all the way from where I park my car if I'm in an apartment or something like that. So what do you think what's driving that behavior, the way that consumers are purchasing your products in-store versus online?
I think some of it is driven by the way retail, offline retail works, right? There's a lot of really large format retail products. There's a lot of big jugs of things in retail, right? Whether it be milk or 32-ounce bottles of juice, or just shelf space is at such a premium at the that they want the largest, oftentimes more efficient way to sell your product so they can carve out margin, but also sell something that has a little bit higher of a price. And so that is, I think, historically what's been built into the retail dynamic. So there's a little bit of just history that I think retailers have continued to leverage. And that makes for an environment where you do have to have a product of a certain size. You have to utilize shelf space to the largest, say, front of pack that you can get, because you have to then compete with other large products that have a ton of shelf space. And so those sort of competitive dynamics make for a business that is driven by larger formats. A lot of the smaller products, particularly in stores today, are in the colder set, right? They're grab-and-go products. Excuse me. They're grab-and-go products that you want to drink right away. Those products actually have higher price points. It's a very premium part of the store. And so if you're a tart cherry juice competing with, say, other very high ring products, frankly, retailers don't have space for you there. And so those dynamics actually prevent smaller products in the beverage space from taking shelf space. And so none of that is driven by consumers.
I totally get it. It's the merchandising of the product that gets it out there. I was going to ask you quickly if you use merchandisers of some kind, either your own team or a third party team, to try to manage your display in store, or is that completely left up to the retailers to decide what they're displaying, which product in which location?
So we have in-house, we have a sales team, right, that does manage retailer relationships directly. Most oftentimes, that's another part of this business that was built from the beginning, was direct relationships with a lot of our retailers, which is pretty unique. Many, because the emergence of distributors has become pretty status quo in the grocery or retail space. That said, we also have sales brokers that are boots on the ground in these markets, oftentimes next to or in these actual retailers' corporate offices, that do help us manage those relationships on the day-to-day. So the answer is, when you have 50,000 placements in 20,000 retailers nationwide, that's a really large footprint to manage on a day-to-day basis. And so, yes, there is. We have the infrastructure to help us manage that business. The interesting thing is doing that online is a completely different landscape. And you actually brought up this point, which I think is really interesting, which is this idea of what do you build and what do you buy? Whether it be a network of brokers or creative agencies, what do you want in-house and what do you want out-of-house? And I think good startups, good CMOs, decide what their competitive advantages are and build those teams. For example, we know our sports teams are a massive competitive advantage. We know our pit crew is one of our biggest assets. Those are programs we're going to build. We want those people to live and breathe our products. We want them in-house. That said, we also have paid social media, and we have PR, and we have all the other sort of things that agencies do much better than I can build overnight. We buy those services. And how we stitch those two things together is what a marketer's responsibility is, to a large degree, because that's how you're going to go to market. That's how you're going to hopefully win. And we've identified those things early on as places which we were going to build. Online sales is the same thing. We manage Amazon operations in-house. We have what we call a center of excellence around e-commerce because we think that is also a place where we need to go faster than the category giants we compete against. And to do that, we have to know our products, we have to know our assortment, we have to know our sales, we have to have those relationships to every degree that we possibly can in the building. But we outsource a lot of paid media because we believe that paid media is something that a lot of different services or agencies can do better than we could. And frankly, we need the scale that they have. So there's not one solve for any one of these sales or marketing sort of problems or situations, but we've tried to be really thoughtful at every stage of growth. When we have a new opportunity, when we go to a new channel, when we invite another e-commerce partner on board, like where do we go and how do we service them? We've tried to take a minute and say, what's the right solution for us around staffing? Because at the end of the day, people will be one of our biggest reasons to win. And we need the right people managing those right channels strategically in order to believe that we can, at the end of the day, have a chance.
Great. Thanks, Rob. I think a couple other quick questions that I wanted to ask, and I know we're running short on time, so we're going to have to wrap up quickly. One is, if I look at what you're building in your business, it's really interesting because it feels like you're almost like a SaaS business more than a beverage business. So it's about building the technology, building the e-commerce infrastructure, building all this stuff, and then ultimately creating some loyalty with your customers to try to get these repeat purchases and subscriptions and things like that. So it's I find it really fascinating how many consumer-oriented products and consumer-oriented companies operate more and more like they're technology companies and almost like subscription software companies, the way things work. So do you see that? Because I know you've got a lot of experience in that area.
It's a good question, Peter. The question around, and at the end of the day, at the end of the rainbow, the pot of gold is all about retention. Whether you're in a SaaS business or you're in a D2C business, you have to retain and monetize the people, the consumers, the partners of which you at one point acquired. There is no CAC to LTV ratio that works unless LTV works. So lifetime value is one of the largest, biggest, most important metrics that any good investor and or startup executive starts to really get close to. So yes, we look at building, call it community. We look at retention, loyalty as a huge leading indicator for the health of our business, knowing that every other sort of metric and investment, frankly, cost of acquisition falls out of LTV, right? The unit economics of growth don't work long-term if you have a leaky bucket. So we have really tried to build that bottoms up, establish quoted product market fit, knowing that tart cherry juices and Cherubundi is niche today. We are on the path to building a monopoly in sports recovery. That's where we are. Because of our team credentials, we're already there in the professional and collegiate athletics. Now we need to take that mainstream. In order to do that mainstream, we need retention from consumers. Otherwise, again, the growth economics don't work. Specifically as you invest in paid media. Yes, I think the mechanics of a SaaS business or a D2C business from a standpoint of looking at retention and loyalty are very much the same. You need to establish product market fit, understand your power user, grow that base to the point which there's diminishing returns, and then figure out how to keep them because they will fund the future investment of bigger, different audiences.
Great. Thanks so much, Rob. And believe it or not, we're actually at the end of our time. I have one more question that I always like to ask, though. And that question is, what advice would you give to current or aspiring CMOs?
Trust your intuition. Believe that the people that build the best brands innovate the new, most interesting products really do have, specifically at the executive level, great intuition about how to win. And I don't care if you work for Coca-Cola or you work for Chairbunny or you work for the next D2C startup that no one's ever heard of. I think there has to be some amount of real understanding that you won't be able to find in data. Because if you're looking for the answer in data, if you're trying to find white space in a category that's filled with large companies, they're already there. They already have that data. They got more competitive information than you can possibly read. So you have to have intuition and some amount of strategic thinking to get ahead. And if you do, bet on that. Because I think that is far more interesting than trying to find the answer in a set of...
Rob, I think that's fantastic advice. And some may find it a little counterintuitive because I think the idea that the answer is always in the data is the easy one in a lot of cases. But you're right. If you are an upstart, you do not have the data advantage. So you really need to have that strategic vision and understanding and alignment to figure out what the right answer is. And sometimes you need to find a way to lean back and figure out how to connect the dots. I really appreciate your time, your invite, your comments today, Rob. Really fantastic interview. And I want to thank you for being on the show. Thank you all for listening. If you have other ideas for guests that you'd like to hear on The Next CMO, send us a note at thenextcmo@planet.com or follow us on social media. And appreciate you for listening and have a great day.
Pod Forte Podcast.